So what is it exactly we're listening to?
What?
What is it exactly we are listening
to? We are listening to Evil Dead. Are you kidding me?
Oh, okay.
Are you recording right now?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I want to get you saying that.
Evil Dead? So, what do you got, the whole movie on there?
No, it's only 7 minutes.
That's how you get psyched up for a day's work.
It's actually...
it's actually my ringtone.
I love a ringtone.
I know.
It's the long-awaited return of the Mad Dog Movies podcast. In this episode, John and I are joined by FX creator Michael Del Rosa. Before we begin, I should mention that there is a short section about halfway through where our main mic stopped recording. Fortunately, I had an iPhone backup running, which actually sounds pretty good. I considered cutting that section out, but really, it's not that bad. So, sit back and enjoy our conversation with Michael Del Rosa of Multivision Effects.
This is, what's the today's date, the 10th?
Today is the 10th.
January 10th?
Yeah.
Yes.
Of 2013. We all survived.
I'm here, my name is John Vincent, and I'm here with Mike Boas, and we are now starting up our podcasting again. If you'd like to say hello, Mike.
Sure, hello. Welcome back.
Today we have a very special guest. His name is Mike Del Rosa. He's from Los Angeles. He's from the East Coast originally, and we've known each other for a number of years, going back at least, I think, 20 years. We worked on a film called After Image, which starred the wonderful John Mellencamp, as yeah. I say sarcastically.
What
Eloise
year was,
Fletcher.
What year was that?
That was 2000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I remember because I was married in the middle of the production. I had to take 2 days off to get married.
Huh.
Okay. And and for those people who have been following Mind Rip, there's a connection there. The one of the lead actresses in our film.
Oh, Kristen Royal, yes.
Kristen Royal, and she was also one of the victims in the film After Image.
Mm-hmm. She was only 13 at the time, too.
And she's actually not that bad of an actress. She's quite good.
No, she's great.
And she's been doing really well. And we filmed quite a bit for Mind Rip in the opening, for the opening 30 minutes of it. But we're in the process of putting that together and shooting some pickup shots. And we will post and you'll be able to see her in action.
Mm-hmm. You like how the introduction turned into John talking about Mind Rip?
Who's here today? I don't remember.
But I was going to say it's always about us. And what we're doing, people are interested in Mind Rip. They don't know who the hell Mike Del Rosa is. No, I'm just kidding. Not really. But Mike also has also worked and done us a favor by doing us a few things on Mind Rip.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So,
maybe some to come. You know, it
hopefully.
Depends.
Yep. We're looking forward to it. Actually, in all seriousness, Mike is very talented, and he's worked on some very big movies, a lot of small movies, big movies, like a lot of people. One of the ones currently is a show called Bite Me, which is on
the Machinima Network. Right?
Machinima. Yeah. But why don't we have Mike talk about it? Why don't you basically give us a little history of how you got started, maybe the first couple of jobs you did, and how you ended up where you are now?
Well, you know what's odd is actually one of the first jobs I ever got was here, and you were on set. In fact, I think you tried to steal my job when you were there.
No, I actually had the job before you.
Oh, okay. That's what it was.
That's what it was.
And then this young, fresh-faced kid came walking in, like, oh, he's going to do all the bullet hits. And, uh-huh. and I remember that. I was like, God, I hate that guy already.
You had it right there.
I know, right? But it was a little film called Minge's Alley shot right here in good old Rochester, New York.
Yeah, and they ended up changing the name to, Moving Target, I think, ultimately.
But
you were talking about...
we drifted again.
How you got started and how you ended up where you are now.
I actually started with an interest in film, obviously, when I was young. And I actually got a hold of my dad's Super 8 camera, like a lot of kids, and tried to do stop-motion animation. It was horrible. But, I mean, I tried doing claymation and and I did it actually in a fish tank. And I think all
Peter
I need,
Jackson, he yeah. did start doing this.
Yeah, but his was thing. Probably, you know, coherent and good. And probably had the sensibility of putting the camera on a tripod.
It's my hard to do stop motion handheld.
It is, I can assure you. Yeah, it was in a fish tank, no less, because they had to swim. I don't know why. But I guess even starting off then, I made things extremely difficult for myself.
I think we all did that, though.
I did
stop motion with a video camera.
Yeah, I tried that as
and,
well.
Yeah, and you hit the button on and off, and it goes kunk, 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 kunk. And no tripod, so I'm doing camera moves too by like pivoting the camera.
I started out doing it. I saw Jason the Argonauts, and I had a camera that was left to the family from my grandfather. It was regular 8,
ooh,
not even super 8. It was regular 8, which was essentially a 16 millimeter film that you ran through the camera, and when that was exposed, you flipped it over. You ran it through again, so it exposed one side of the film and the other. You sent it off to the lab, and
slice it down the middle, right?
Yeah. Wow. And on the camera, you'd have to click it really fast to get the one frame.
Mm.
So, but anyway, continue.
Well, I mean, from there, I had an interest in horror films, and I think that my inspirations actually started with magazines. My recollections were reading creepy magazines at a very early age, perhaps a little too young to be reading creepy magazines in particular, because those aren't intended really for children. If you look at the stories and the violence,
they weren't. I remember looking at those myself.
And again, it's not necessarily the I wasn't really into famous monsters. Oddly enough, my generation was more of the Fangoria. I started off with Fangoria early on, and in fact, I remember my first time ever seeing a Fangoria. There was a small market that was around where we lived, and I was begging my father for this issue, and this sticks out in my mind to this day. It was the issue with Motel Hell, with the guy with the chainsaw.
Right.
And I begged him and begged him and begged, and
Farmer Vincent.
Vincent, but don't you know that's the one magazine that's worth like $300 now.
Really?
Oh yeah. It's the one. And for some reason, I think it's because of the cover. Because
I had all the first issues of Starlog and Fangoria, and I didn't think they're worth anything.
Well, that one in particular, because I think
that's the cover, why they're worth something. Yeah. Because no one thought they were worth anything.
Right. Well, the cover also, I think, is the one that caught a lot of flack because it had the chainsaw and the blood and the pig head and all that stuff.
Yeah, it was kind of ahead of its time, Fangoria.
Was ahead of a pig.
Yeah. In fact, I was one of the few people that used to read that magazine when I was in high school. And I ended up getting the nickname Fangoria.
Wow.
So kids would actually call me that.
They named you after a whole magazine?
Yes. Well, you know, where I went to school, kids weren't all that bright. But that's what, you know.
Well, you know. They weren't bright at mine either.
It wasn't my idea to call
No myself. Offense to anyone at Gates Chili through the years.
Well, yeah, I tried growing up in Henrietta, see what happens. Chris Nakis, who was a producer, went to Henrietta too, and that's all I got to say about that.
Well, we know about him. Actually, we love Chris. Chris is amazing. He's an amazing guy.
Well, we're going to have a new game, but Chris has been involved with a number of feature film productions around here that we've all worked on.
Did you forget the word failed feature?
No,
I'm kidding.
But he's been actually in them in various parts, and he's either inside the makeup, or he's a character, or he's got a hood over his head and he's running through it. So I'm going to have Mike tell you what we're going to do.
Yeah, well, certainly on DVDs of these features, we want to do extras that are Spot the Nakus extras.
And so, it's like a game.
Yeah. I like this.
It turned it into a drinking game, perhaps. Ooh. And, you know, we have... at the last screening, you know, I was leaning over to, there's Nakus. Every time he'd show up. But it was, he probably played 8 roles in that.
A movie we all worked on. Awesome. Mike did some blood hits and some old age makeup on a film called 3.14, which is kind of trying to get into the festival circuit now. And Chris was in that a lot.
Yeah, he was.
In fact, on one scene, we have him running. We had to have someone running across in the outside in the dark. And
we just needed a shot of someone.
We just one shot. Yeah, it was wet out. It was raining out, and it was a real quick lighting setup outside. And we're inside this girl's room shooting out the window. And so we had to say, all right, Chris, all right, go ahead. Keep running back and forth. So just to get him, after I called cut and I was telling everybody to take all the stuff down, I kept telling him to keep running. So everybody's like taking the gear out. We're still having Chris running back and forth out in the rain.
Well, I'm surprised he actually did it with clothes on.
I know.
That's the game.
Yeah, he has a penchant for getting naked.
Yeah. That's the name Nakus.
Let's go. Brings us right back to where we were. Yeah. All right, so you were
You bought
saying,
some Fangorias.
You bought some Fangorias.
You went out west. Well, no, no, no. Actually, my father wouldn't purchase that one in particular for me. That's the one, ironically, that's worth, you know, yeah, a right. bunch of money. But anyways, so I Fangorias, Creepy Magazines. This was like how I formulated my idea of what horror is, horror film, through Fangoria and early 80s horror films and that type of thing. Evil Dead. Oh yes, Evil Dead, because I'm such a fan, and they've done a remake. This is 2013, and at first, I mean, we'll just get this briefly quickly out of the way. 2013, they're going to release this a remake of a favorite movie of mine, Evil Dead, and I'm a huge fan of the original. And I wanted to dislike it because a lot of remakes are not done very well,
most of them aren't.
Yeah, and it really does break the heart because when you're a fan of something that they've made, perhaps produced in the 80s or whatever, and then you go and you watch this, and it's like, I mean, all this time has elapsed, and couldn't they make it better? You would think, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, Evil Dead, the trailers that have been out, I think it looks really, really good. I hope so too. I hope I'm not being misled because obviously they put the best things in the trailer sometimes or whatever, but I think there's going to be a lot more that isn't in the trailer.
They're using the same mantra as us too, which is no CGI. They're doing everything practically. It looks, serious.
It
doesn't look campy. And that's some people are like, oh, but Evil Dead should be, kind of funny. And the original was the ultimate experience in grueling terror.
Yes. Now, and if you watch the original, people only kind of know them from like Part 2 or even Army of Darkness, which are campy. Yeah. But the first one is dead serious. And that's the way I like it.
There are laughs, perhaps. But
unintentional, I would imagine.
Now, Evil Dead 2 was played a lot for the humor.
Right. Yes. Right, on purpose. Yeah.
On purpose, yeah.
Because they wanted to get a better rating. But if you watch the first one, it's far more intense. I think it's a little bit more mean-spirited.
I saw it when it first came out of the theater.
I did too. It was me, a friend of mine, my sister, and one old guy way in the front, and that was it. Mm-hmm. But it was awesome. I saw Evil Dead. I mean, not many people can say that, but then are we dating ourselves? I mean,
I don't know. I never dated you. Did you ever date me?
I don't think so.
I don't remember.
I remembered that myself. But to have seen that in the movie theaters was awesome. I mean, that was...
Yeah, I remember not knowing what to expect. I had read a little bit about it, knowing that they had done it for a very low budget. They had gone door to door, basically trying to raise money for it. And that was my dream, was to make a film like that. And I was pretty impressed when I saw it as a kid. I wasn't that young. I was like, I think I must have been 18 years old. But
yeah, 83. Yeah.
Finish what you're saying.
I don't even remember now.
Oh God.
So you see Evil Dead. You say this is my deal.
Oh, that's right.
And
yes.
Then
we drift each time away. But the Evil Dead series. Yeah. Well, I mean, I just saw a lot of horror films. I mean, it was the thing to do. I think also my parents like mentally scarred me in many ways. but the one that actually kind of had been somewhat beneficial is they took me to inappropriate movies. I mean, you don't take a kid to go see The Shining when he's about the age of little Danny there.
Yeah.
And I mean, and you know, just so yeah. I think the
And mine was the Corpse Grinders. My parents took Corpse Grinders at the drive-in.
I remember. This will be a good one for little Johnny.
Yeah. Yeah, here you go.
Don't look at the screen. Turn your head away.
Did they try to cover your eyes and stuff?
No, I was inside a little with a VW, a little Beetle, and my sister and I are in the back seat and we saw this. And the trilogy, not Trilogy of Terror, the one where Santa Claus goes around killing people.
Yep. Silent Night,
Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt. Yes. Yeah, it was like a double feature.
I remember that.
Yeah. So like, I'm trying to turn.
You're wrong.
No, it's Tales from the Crypt. It's the first three stories.
The first episode of Tales from the Crypt, the TV show, had the killer Santa Claus.
No, it was a movie.
That's
a remake.
The Amicus picture that had Tales from the Crypt did not.
Because it had the famous actress with the dark hair. What's her name?
They're all black.
No.
Collins, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Joan Collins.
Yes.
Did it have a killer Santa Claus in it too?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Welcome to the crypt. You are invited on a guided tour of a world of darkness where nightmares become reality. Who's next? Perhaps. perhaps you?
I'm remembering the Peter Cushing
she kills
part.
Her husband.
I'm remembering the guy with all the razor blades.
Yes. Yeah, the razor blades. Yep. Yeah, that's the same one.
That's one
yeah.
of the first movies I remember seeing as a kid. Yeah,
me too.
Yes.
Me too. That was a horror
How
movie.
How strange. I wonder if we saw it together in different cars.
Wasn't it, was it the drive-in you saw?
Yes. It was funny. At the drive-in theaters.
That's funny.
In fact, I recollect having a little pajamas.
The fact that we're actually saying drive-ins actually dates us pretty well.
Yeah. But, I wouldn't date.
I saw a lot of movies at the drive-in. So. I mean, yeah. I saw Dawn of the Dead. I saw The Phantasm at the drive-in too.
Yeah.
Those are the right movies to see at the drive-in, I would think.
But movies were different back then because it felt like my cousin would tell me about something he might have seen, and just him, even in a kid telling a kid, it's like it created like the story in your mind that still to this day is like it's something. It's I don't know how to put it, but it's kind of a. Like the fantasy you suspect a movie's going to be, and then you go to see it like in the movie theaters back then, it was something rewarding. It's I think a lot of that's kind of
there's a lot of creativity even in the low budget stuff. I mean, even the story wise and visual wise. I mean, I think Night of the Living Dead is a prime example of that, where there was a big payoff.
What I particularly like about that movie is there's a sense of paranoia and there's a sense of feeling like there's it almost feels like, even though it's only at this farmhouse, I love the shots where they show the news footage because it gives a sense of feel like it's happening everywhere. It's like, you know, and to me, it's like that was one of the mistakes of, say, like the remake or something, is that giving that sense of it's happening everywhere kind of a thing.
The Dawn of the Dead remake I thought was good for the first 20 minutes.
It was good. It was a good one.
You know, but and then after that, I just couldn't get into it too much.
I just, the thing that, there's certain things, it's like if you're a purist, you know, I mean, and I hate to never say never, but it's like, you know, the whole thing with zombies that run and that type of thing.
It's a different thing.
It is. But I mean, it's like, to me, it's like sometimes you break something like almost a rule, and it's like, even though there should be no rules in filmmaking, but I mean, it just feels like sometimes you do stuff like that. If they're doing it just for the sake of breaking a rule, then it's kind of, it doesn't really serve the purpose. And not only that, I think it kind of pulls you away from what makes them creepy. It's creepy like because they do kind of gang up on you.
Right,
suddenly,
slowly. That's what I found really scary. Yeah. I was never afraid of much in terms of going to the movies and stuff, but the couple of movies that did frighten me were a couple of George Romero films, The Thing, and you know, all those movies. It was actually a slow progression to within the movie of getting scared, and then the sense of these zombies slowly walking towards you, and even though you can run and get away from them, they're just still slowly, and there's more of them, and they don't stop, and they just keep coming, and it doesn't matter what you do.
And it always seems like there's a point where the character, for some reason or another, can't necessarily run around them.
Right.
And whatever happens, say, like, I get the gas tank, the thing explodes, blah, blah, blah. There's something that kind of slows them up for that momentary thing where they're, you know, they have their weak moment, and then they get them. Mm-hmm. It's almost more predatory, you know what I mean, in a way, sort of?
Well, they both, I mean, it's funny, because The Thing and Night of the Living Dead both have this point at which they've got a plan, it's all going to be fine, and then the worst thing happens, the truck catches on fire, or they lose, you know, I can't remember, there's certainly a couple points in The Thing where, oh crap, we're not going to solve this problem and get out of this alive.
The only thing we can do is kill it and ourselves.
Right. Alien is an example, it scared the hell out of me in the movie theater, the first Alien. Very slow-paced film. I mean, not a lot of action going on.
I never saw it in the movie theater.
I was 12 when I saw it in a movie theater.
I went to see E.T.
It was the only... this came out at the same time. Yeah. Around the same time. Yeah. That was the only movie that I was having a hard time looking at the screen on, actually. It got me so nervous. Mm. And you compare that to movies made today, which are so kinetic and just keep going, just barrage you with one thing after another. And you watch Alien. It's very slow. The camera moves in. You know, very slowly. It's a really nice buildup. There's only one major violent scene in that whole film, and that's with the chest buster.
Yeah.
The rest of the movie plays up on that, and you never really see anything majorly violent after that, but it scared the hell out of me.
Yeah. It's so great, too, because, like, the way they set that up, it's like even the actors didn't even know it was coming. Like,
Veronica
Cartwright fell over a couch and stuff. And, like, how could you not? I mean, they're setting up this, you know, whatever they walk them in, this guy, John Hurt, popped through a table.
I've heard that story. Yeah. I'm like, how did you not know what was going to happen?
Well, what they did was they took the blood tubes and they actually aimed them at the actors.
Yes, because you can see it, like, comes right up at her face.
Which they didn't realize that was going to happen.
Yeah. Wow, that's good.
Yeah.
It's always a good thing to do.
So, you know, you grew up, you saw these films.
Yes.
And how did they influenced you? And then what did you do after that? How did these mold what you were...
Did you do stuff in high school? Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in the beginning, going back a little bit, I think the initial movie, seeing these movies, scared the hell out of me. And as a kid, I had like nightmares. So mm-hmm. I think the only way to mentally like get a grasp on it is to understand it and delve into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny too, because growing up, I didn't have a lot of friends who were necessarily into horror films. I mean, they were casual interest.
Sure.
But me, of course, I just delved into it. And to me, it was like, you know, that's what my whole thing was wrapped around. And so needless to say, being a loner in high school, I mean, I did have that one interest, and that in filmmaking. I took a television or radio broadcasting course to get into, you know, understanding the equipment and how to...
Did you find other people that had similar interests with you at that age, or was that difficult?
Well, again, it wasn't necessarily like again, if it was a horror interest, their interests were more casual. It was passing. It wasn't like they were like into it as much as I was.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the same issue. There was like me and one other person that mm-hmm. had any kind of interest.
Or if you wanted to, quote unquote, make a movie, you know, with your video camera or something, you might get a couple buddies together, but their interests might be waning, you know, and then they would probably like, oh yeah, after half a day they're tired. Yeah. I hear my mother calling me, I gotta go.
Right.
But you know, I would experiment.
You guys aren't taking this seriously.
A little mini Hitler director back then, but I would do like experiments with effects. I special makeup effects was something that always interests me, and I don't know. I guess I approached it a little bit differently. In the very beginning, I had this very elitist attitude. Like I couldn't sculpt, say, a Freddy mask, or I couldn't do something that's already been done. It has to be pure. It has to be something.
Something original.
And then through the years, I realized, well, you know what? When you understand the concept of design and designing, it's like everything is a reference of something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I mean, not to say that you go and you rip off something necessarily, but even if you use nature.
Well, if you did, you'd be Brian De Palma.
Yeah, exactly.
That's another story.
But say you're designing a makeup effect or a character or creature for a movie, you take things from nature. I mean, that's reference. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. you can use other things from other people's bodies of work, not necessarily like, you know, lifting directly, mm-hmm. but I mean things that are inspirational, something that has a feeling, something that emotes.
So what was the first thing that you remember doing that you thought was, wow, I can really do this and go into it as a profession? When did it go past being a hobby and an interest to something, well, I'm going to try to make a living at it?
Oh, well, I mean, it's weird. I got a call from a friend of mine who was working on, oddly enough, Night of the Demons Part 3. And they were shooting it up in Montreal, Canada. And actually, there's a book coming out, and they're going to do an interview. I'm one of the few people who have photographs and some information and some stories of some of the antics and the... that was my first professional movie working on, would be Night of the Demons Part 3. And so I went up to Montreal, Canada, more Quebec area. It was French, the French Republic there. Mm-hmm. And we shot there. And it's weird because, as well as experiences where it's so intense and you're working, say, like 22 hours, you go back to the hotel, you're tired. I mean, had I known years later and had that experience, I would have been like, what am I doing? And just turn around and never have. But to me, it was like, okay, I'm working on one of the Night of the Demons movies.
Yeah.
How mm-hmm. cool is that? It's like, okay, yeah. It's Part 3. It's one of the first things I'm ever being professionally asked to do. I drove all this way. I'm applying makeup right there. Emilia Kincaid and, you know, the characters are all there. And
very exhilarating just to finally get to your you know what you've been playing with and working on as a hobby and watching these movies and then make the connection that, oh, I'm actually
part of
the system, and what I'm doing is actually going to be seen by a bunch of people, like that. What I was watching, and I would follow magazines and read about these people, and then all of a sudden,
then you're part of that.
You're
lore.
Part of that whole thing, and it's a whole shift in mentality, and it's very, very exhilarating. I found for myself.
Oh God,
gives you reason to keep going.
Yeah, it's almost a rush. It's like, and people. It's funny. Like I make sure whenever I have someone working with me doing effects or whatever, that they're credited. To anyone that I might have missed, I apologize. But I mean, I always make it a point, and I've worked for people before in the past where, you know, you don't get credited for something. And it's I'll tell you something. Yeah, we could all raise our hand on that one. Yeah. I mean, I've saved people's, you know, done whole shows for people, and then you look at the credits, and it's their company. I mean, like, I understand right. the mentality, oh, I hired you, it's mine. But it's like, you know what? The least someone can do is give you a credit, because to me, that's almost an indelible mark in film history. That is an indelible thing. Someone could go back for whether a good movie or a bad movie, go back and look at someone's name and go, look, okay, John Vincent worked on this. Michael Del Rosso worked on this. Yeah. Mike Bose.
I had that happen you know? With Freak, that movie Freak.
Yeah, and it's kind of a deflating thing when it does happen, and when you've put in an effort for someone, and sometimes it's for someone else, and for usually virtually nothing, and you know, and then the least they can do is make sure that they give you some sort of credit, and all they have to do is put in a phone call. Trust me.
Well,
I've spent
weeks designing and building the stop motion armature for the animated shoe sequence in Freaked.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group of us working on doing other. I did that. Obviously, other people did other stuff, and the production is the PAs. Got credit that were helping us out.
Craft service.
I didn't. I don't know if it was an oversight, if someone had gotten mad at me for something.
Yeah.
Well, but one consolation these days is IMDb. You can at least put your own credits in.
I've had some people say where they actually had trouble putting credits in there because for one reason or another their name didn't appear on there, or they didn't have the evidence.
Yeah.
But what's weird is I think
if you have a track record on other projects,
it
makes it a little bit easier.
Well, I find like now I'll go on there and stuff will be already on there that we haven't even completed. You know, I'm like,
someone else is there ahead of you.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I'm getting hired for this. Okay, well, that's cool.
That's another thing. If you really want to see a list of the movies that Mike Del Rosso has done, you can go on the IMDb punch his name in, and a lot of that will show up.
Should I do the correct spelling? So make sure.
Yes, give them the correct spelling of your name so they know.
Well, obviously it's Michael, but the last name is capital D-E-L space capital R-O-S-S-A.
So you can go on right now while you're listening to this and check out exactly what he's done. It's a lot. It's pretty extensive.
Or the website. Credibles. The website's a lot of fun.
Well, give him your website too.
Oh yeah, you know I'll give that out.
Go ahead.
Okay, it's multivisionfx.com. Yes, I will. It's multivisionfx.com.
And of course, we'll have that up too on the site, so you'll be able to read it.
Oh, definitely.
So the first thing, I don't know, I met you a few years ago through John, and at that point, you had just recently done The Fallen Ones, which I had seen.
Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, yeah, that's actually going back a while now.
The Mummy movie, right?
Yeah.
And that was the point where maybe you'd worked on Van Helsing at that point and some other things, but I was like, The Fallen Ones? I own that DVD. And I went back and watched the extras and saw you in the extras again. I was like, oh, okay.
That's funny.
This mummy is one of the Nephilim. They were the offspring of fallen angels and human women. He is one of the angels that God sent to destroy Sodom.
We will all be destroyed by a great deluge of water.
Get your gun! I hit it. I think it pissed it off.
Nice drive.
Get in.
I hadn't gotten to shoot anything yet.
You are going to fail.
But they have to try hard. That's what I do. This can't be happening.
It is. Giant mummies, fallen angels, all of it.
That's one of those jobs where, and you've done a few things, where you end up doing maybe a lot on a small production versus a little on a big production.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Samurai, what was it?
Samurai Avenger, movie? For my good friend Kurando Mitsutaki.
I love that one.
Dear friend of mine.
I still have your DVD of that.
Oh, you do?
It looks like they're trading it back and forth.
Yeah, that's what we do. Mostly I borrow them from Mike because he's got a lot of them. But yeah,
it's a fun movie. You know, it's
I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, I think it was exactly the kind of sort of trashy, you know, action Western
samurai mashup shooting out of people and
but you ended up having to do tons on that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And probably are you reusing the same bucket of blood over and over?
No, I mean, we went through like, I don't know, like 50 gallons of blood on that thing. But I mean, it was for the love of my friend Corando. It really was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't about, I mean, whatever, you know, whatever he had, we were willing to make it happen for him,
right,
just because it was fun.
Who gave you permission to be out here?
Someone will surely take you back.
I was told they'll just be the blind men.
Samurai Avenger, the Blind Wolf. This time, revenge is blind.
I mean, when you look at the effects, they're kind of over the top. They're a little cheesy, but it was intentional. Again, I think part of one of my philosophies is when I get a screenplay and I'm doing a breakdown, or if I'm talking to a director and I begin to get a feel for what the material is, I do not want to make effects necessarily stand out in the sense of, here's something I did for your film. Mm-hmm. It's more, okay, here's your film, and I'm going to do effects that will fit your project.
Right.
Like back in the day, I felt like, maybe effects were, and it's kind of cool that, you would go to a certain effects guy to get a certain look. That's cool. But I mean, to me, it seems like it's more of a service to the film if you can make your effects and everything augment and work with the project.
Right.
And that's one thing that a philosophy I've always worked towards, to try and make sure that we integrate into each and every project and in whichever fashion, whether it's hyper realistic, like some of the stuff for After Image back in the day. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then, like Samurai Avenger, over the top.
Yep.
And then somewhere in between, although comical, is some of the stuff with, the Fallen Ones.
Right.
What project are you most proud of?
Well, I'll tell you. No, I mean, it's funny. Are we talking the film itself, or are we talking the stuff we produced for the film? Because I mean, there's a difference.
You know what? There is a difference. Yeah. What is it that you are most proud of if someone asks you? So, what have you worked on? What's the first thing that comes to your mind to tell them?
Oh, wow. I don't know. There's so many different things. I mean, I was going to say the Fallen Ones, only because I was really proud of the way that we were able to, I mean, I started with the intention of, I wanted to make the mummies look like real mummies. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't want them to look like wrapped up in all this, gauze or whatever, to hide the fact that we didn't have a suit or whatever. My intentions were to make it look
like a real mummy. And I think for all intents and purposes, if you go back and watch that movie, it's the one thing, when you see the shots of the real people in the suit, they look good.
Yeah, they look really good. Contrasted to some of the CG stuff.
Horrible.
Yeah. and good friends with the guy who did that stuff. But I mean, it's like, with that aside, it's like, it was too contrasty, and unfortunately, we didn't get enough footage while we were shooting the production of the suits, because they did look really, really decent.
Yeah, I remember them looking pretty good.
And I mean, but that's the philosophy that I approach with everything, is to go back and look at what reality is and utilize that as a starting point, a springboard, if you will.
Who were your influences? Who did you, in terms of makeup effects?
Like a lot of, kids probably, back in the day, I started off a big Tom Savini and Dick Smith fan. But then through the years, I've grown and appreciated Dick Smith's...
Explain this to the people who Dick Smith is. He hasn't been in the field for quite some time.
Yeah,
but to a big group of us, he would be, the father of stuff. Tell him who he is.
I mean, Dick Smith is the legend of special makeup effects. I mean, if it wasn't for his generosity and his just his ability to put the information out there, I think more so than anyone else. I mean, his generosity. Just if you were to ask him, he'll talk to you like a normal human being and just and be the sweetest person in the world. And you know, I mean, and to write back to every single, almost every single person that wrote to him. I mean, I thought about that the other day. I'm like, that must have took so much time.
Well, I had Dick Smith's story. I was in 10th grade, I think, and Altered States had just come out, and that was a big deal in terms of makeup effects because it's when they started using the air bladders and the Change-O stuff, and that was really the beginning of all that stuff. I had somehow gotten Dick Smith's phone number. Because he used to live in Larchmont, outside of New York City. So I called him up, and he answered the phone. And I told him who I was. I said, my name is John Vincent. I'm in 10th grade. I'm trying to do makeup effects stuff. There's no one around here to help me. I saw Altered States. I was wondering if you could give me some kind of idea on how I might be able to do that and how you did it. He spent 45 minutes with me on the telephone.
That's
giving me exact ideas, you know, descriptions on how he did it, and what materials I should get, where to get the materials, and how to execute these effects that he did. And I'm like, you know, I'm drifting back and forth trying to write this stuff down, thinking Dick Smith is actually talking to me on the telephone.
And it's not like there's a certain amount of purity there. I mean, he didn't like cut you short.
No,
he didn't say, hey kid, I gotta go or whatever. And
he seemed very enthusiastic about trying to help me.
So, for those who don't know, he did the old age makeup, Little Big Man, Exorcist, Altered States, The Hunger, right?
Yeah, he did The
One
Hunger.
One of my favorite vampire movies,
A film called Ghost Story. He oh my God, he did so many things. He started off at NBC doing a lot of TV shows and then worked his way into feature films.
But before him, there were, I mean, makeup guys usually treated things like magic tricks.
Yes,
like,
they did not want other people to know their techniques.
They were trade secrets.
Yeah.
So one guy might not know what the other guy was doing, but he would share his information.
Like you would know, hey, those are foam rubber makeup appliances, but what is foam rubber? How do you get that? What's
The other guy's using gelatin, and he's looking at your stuff, and you won't tell him what it is. It's like, come on,
Right. You come to find out it's very complicated. Back then, making foam rubber was like 6-7 different chemicals having to mix together, and no one would even know that stuff. And then R&D, remember R&D foam?
Oh God, yeah.
Was a real simplified version of
three parts
making foam rubber, and that's I got that from Dick Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So you try the R&D foam, and that'll work for you.
Yeah.
So
I don't even think they make that anymore.
No, that went under.
No,
yeah.
Oh boy.
And then Savini, did you ever cross paths with him? Did you ever?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a good story.
That's the look I see right.
All right, someone asked me the other day if I ever crossed paths with him, and that was my reaction, too. Because I saw him at a convention, I did a sort of fanboy thing, and he didn't really respond.
He's very rude
person. We have a lot of friends that have worked for Savini.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and he's actually, you get mixed things. He's, some people say he's very nice, and some people say...
You got to catch him on the right day, I think.
And other people say, because I know a lot of people that did a lot of sculpting, like on Day of the Dead and some of the other movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we know a couple of people that worked on that. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Volich and...
In fact, did I ever show you my the comic book thing that somebody...
You have that?
Yes, I do.
You got a copy of that?
Yeah.
I was supposed to...
This part you might have to edit out.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we have a friend of ours that was a sculptor on Day of the Dead. And he's one of the best artists. And in fact, at the time, I think maybe 5 people had his ability out there. I think Steve Wang was probably at the top of the list. And then some other people, and this person was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he had done a comic book of the people on the set of
Tommy Dearest.
Tommy Dearest.
Yes. So I have that.
Oh, I got to get a copy of it. Anyway, I was supposed to be a zombie in Day of the Dead.
Uh-huh.
Well, after that comic book came out, my friend, who I won't say his name, was not working on the project anymore. And so I was not able to go down to Florida and be one of the zombies. And I was very, very, very upset about that.
I
hold that against him to this very day.
God. Well, I'll have to get you a copy of that.
Oh, my God. Well, God, that was so funny.
Yeah. Well, you haven't seen the comic strip yet.
I saw the original when
the
he was doing
him,
it.
The one that got him.
Yeah. Oh, it's like, I go, you did what? You did this and you handed it out? Oh. It's still funny, though.
Good for him.
Bad decision.
Bad decision.
But,
but a
nice little piece of history. Thank you very much.
Back in the 80s, it was it was just the gung-ho. Everything's gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
Big shows going on. you couldn't have enough effects people working.
That's true.
And by the time I got out to Los Angeles, which is in the early 90s, it was still going pretty strong.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Jurassic Park came out.
Yeah, I remember.
And because I was working at Dave Allen Productions at the time.
T2, too, was another.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And all of a sudden, everybody jumped on the computer graphics bandwagon. Boom, dried up. Everything dried up. Hmm. Dead. Nobody was shooting. You know, my specialty was doing miniatures and creature effects, but in the stop motion animation realm, you're obviously doing the special makeup effects. Mm-hmm. Now, I know it all took a huge hit. And the last big show that I ever worked on was that movie Freaked.
Right.
You know, and after that.
It's a great movie, by the way.
Yeah, with some cool stuff. And I think everybody and their grandmother worked on that show.
But it's so awesome. It's just such a great little movie. It's like, I don't even know if they could, if they
you
wanted.
You should have gone to the rat party.
I couldn't only imagine.
It was at the Aeronautical Museum.
But I mean, think of all the effects guys involved with that. And then just, I mean, like all the stuff in the movie. And then just the context of the movie. If they'd even be able to try and pull that off.
It costs a fortune today.
Just like a different time. And it's like.
Oh my God, everybody. I mean the shoe that I made the armature for was sculpted by Screaming Mad George.
Right,
I have stories about him.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, everybody. I don't think there was one person at the time that didn't work on that. Had a hand in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Johnson did.
Steve Johnson, yeah. Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody did. I mean, there's such a ton of stuff in that.
It is.
What I'm getting to is it died.
Right? Yeah.
So how did you weather that storm and continue on working in the business when so many other people had, you know, went into doing other things?
Well, it's funny, when I first got out to L.A., which I wish I had gone sooner, personally, but I finally got out there after...
Oh, this is full. I have no idea how long this is for. Wow. We have these. Here we
go. We got some backup.
Yay!
Please stand by. We are experiencing technical difficulties.
Well, we were talking about the push-pull between CG and movies and traditional effects. I know you're involved with I Am Legend.
Yes.
The Will Smith, I Am Legend adaptation. Now, that was going to be physical effects that you were working on?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I don't know if I'd necessarily call it a push-pull, but it's a prime example of how the digital effects have an advantage over practical effects in the sense that they can walk into a meeting or even after something's been done and go, hey, we can save the world, you know, or whatever. I mean, I do see the advantages of digital effects. On that project in particular, all intentions always start off good with movies. I mean, I don't think anyone sets off to go, oh, we're going to make a horrible movie.
Right.
I mean, when I first heard, you know, about the movie, I was excited. And I was brought in at a pretty decent position where I was actually developing Will Smith's makeup, his own personal scars and all this stuff. I won't get into that too much, the politics of how that went down. But I saw how the movie, when we were working on it, it went from effects house to effects house to effects house, and they were spending so much money.
Trying to develop the look of the zombie vampire people.
But right. I think, again, that was a more of an issue of one of those situations where it's... too many chefs in the kitchen and or, you know, too many opinions... you know, being formulated without having a constant direction. One person saying, yes, no, this is what I want.
6 billion people on Earth when the infection hit. I'm a survivor living in New York City. I will be at the South Street Seaport every day at midday when the sun is highest in the sky. Didn't do this. We did.
As So we're basically for months and months developing and coming up with all these different ideas of doing translucent prosthetics and things where you can see the muscles underneath and all this stuff that's never been done before.
What are the transfers, the makeup transfers for that?
Well, I started off doing Will Smith's makeup because he was supposed to be covered in all these scars from all his battles where he's been bitten because he wasn't able to transform into one of the...
Right, so he's immune.
Right, exactly. Right. So he has all these scars. So I had just gotten off of doing 300, and before that I had done the transfers, had helped with the transfers for Passion of the Christ.
Explain what a transfer is.
I'm sorry. There's a makeup process, there's prosthetics, and then there's a process we call transfers, which is sort of similar to, say, a flat mold. As opposed to having a three-dimensional mold that wraps around someone's face, these are done in a flat, like, say, a flat plate, and then you say, scrape a material in there and peel it out and apply that. That is your prosthetic. And it wraps around the contours on the person.
And it's painted and it has the scar image on it.
It could. You mean pre-painting? I mean, that could be done. That could be done before. Yes, but the process was something that was brought in on Passion of the Christ because Jim Caviezel's body was just covered head to toe in these scars, and the quickest way to for us to do them were to do them in these pieces and make these transfers, as opposed to also another problem is with large pieces is movement. When you start moving, these things crinkle, and if they're joined together, it's the same analogy of say a whole piece mask, as opposed to having prosthetics broken up on the face. Right. When you start moving and it's all together, it begins to crinkle and do weird things. So the ideology on Passion of the Christ was making all these individual pieces. And also his brutalization, Christ being beaten and all this stuff is a lineage. It's in stages. So we had to produce these pieces so they could be put on and then...
And take off and put on the next one.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean... with that said, at the end, I mean, his body was covered in these things, and they were, I mean, it was an ordeal, but I mean, the process in itself,
How long does it take to apply all that
stuff? Well, it depends on how many there were. Like, I remember we did some test makeups before they ever went to Italy and shot anything, and, we're talking, like, if we were doing a head-to-toe makeup, I mean, it could be, like, 4 hours with four people working on them.
So would they have to shut down or shoot something else while you're replying?
Yeah, I mean, it would be... proper scheduling and stuff. Yeah. Like, I never went to Italy, unfortunately. I would have loved to have gone. It was one of those scenarios where they thought it best to keep me in the shop as opposed to sending me out on location. But I would have loved to have gone to Italy and done that.
I bet.
Yeah. Anyway, so the process I brought to the movie 300, where you see all the scars. There's the one that goes across, was it Leonardo or Leonardo's eye? I can't remember the character's name.
I don't remember the character.
Yeah, but they were all scarred up from battles and whatever. And I did a one-man department. I did all the transfers and scars for that movie, and also worked on some of the characters and dead bodies and some of the creatures as well. Then took that process over to I Am Legend, which is with the Will Smith's makeup. From that, moved over into the I guess what you would call them, what, vampire?
The infected, kind
of, the infected.
Yeah.
The infected character, where we were doing all these tests. And some of the stuff, I don't think we've ever even... I have photographs of things that have never been seen that we've done that had, like, layering techniques where you would see the muscle underneath like a translucent layer of skin, and we were just developing things that were pretty innovative.
I remember seeing some of those images and I was really impressed with them, and I remember seeing the CG in the movie and I was not impressed with that.
Yeah, I know.
For a couple of reasons. One thing, it looked like CG, a red CG.
Oh, like with the nutcracker jaw. It's like, what?
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't understand, because I remember you telling me that at some point in the movie, in the process, they went from one to the other. Now, explain how that happened.
Well, it was strange. I think what it was is, again, it was, and I hate to say this, I mean, it was somewhere further down the line. It wasn't necessarily anyone took a look at, like, anything we were doing and said, oh, no, we can't use that. It was more, I think, indecisionness is what caused the problems, and then to solve the problems they went to a whole different thing and just said, okay, we'll just finish it this way.
So they shot They shot prosthetic stuff for some scenes, right?
It is my understanding that they did shoot some stuff, yeah, but I know for a fact after they were done with our shop, when we worked on it 6 months, they went to another shop, and to another shop, and to another shop. So I'm sure they've spent like a lot of money on the effects, which is...
Yeah, and then after going to those shops, they went to the computer.
Yeah, and then they turned around and did it with
which
computers.
Which is incredibly expensive.
Yes.
And they may have actually rushed it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because you could tell.
It could have looked better.
Yeah. Could have looked I mean, the stuff we were doing.
Could have looked better. And I don't know why they kept to change the end of the Richard Matheson story.
Oh, completely
changed. I heard it was Mike's fault.
Was it your fault?
No, of course. Why wouldn't it be?
We had to change the end of the story because of these damn makeup transfers.
And you know what? You know what's funny is actually I'm a huge fan of the Vincent Price one.
I love that. Last Man.
And that kept the ending, I think.
Yeah, that was very true. Because he wrote the script. Richard Matheson wrote the script for that.
This is my favorite version of that story.
It's beautiful. And it's like, and then, I mean, along comes this. And I was
shot in Italy?
That was shot in Italy, yeah.
I was so excited. I was like, oh, great. We're going to work on I Am Legend. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, Italy doubling for post-apocalyptic L.A.
Yeah.
But
Vincent Price driving around in a station wagon.
I'd rather be in the post-apocalyptic Italy than present day.
I still think it's the best version, though. I do, too. I like the Omega Man, which is...
Charlton Heston.
It's almost standalone. You know what I mean? It kind of is.
A little different than... Yeah,
it
yeah.
is, but
it's of it's of the 70s.
Yeah.
It's Charlton Heston sci-fi horror is what it you know. It's no Planet of the Apes or whatever, but
so getting back to CGI and the practical thing, I think again what it would have boiled down to is indecisiveness. I know at one point someone had the idea of covering all the infected with this white fallout mud. Mm. So they would cover their bodies with this white mud. And it's like one of those ideas, it's like, okay, so some chief somewhere came up with this great idea.
Hey,
like,
I just saw this Predator. Yeah. I saw the movie Predator, and Schwarzenegger covered himself up in mud. Let's do it here.
Well, it almost sounds like an Italian cannibal idea, too.
Yeah.
This movie.
Yeah.
So
it looked, you know, it was an okay concept.
Yeah.
But I'll just make this brief. I guess apparently they even went so far as to shoot test footage and... I guess apparently they had a footage of all these infected
white characters
white chasing after one Will Smith.
One black character.
Yeah, and they took a look at that and they're like, we can't do this.
Let's have it take place in the South.
Maybe they should be wearing some hoods.
Here's the thing. All they needed were like burning stuff. But I mean, so far as to say, like, I mean, this is how much like money was wasted. I mean, we had produced, I think, over 100 bodies, polyfoam bodies, and like in positions, because they were supposed to be like all these bodies in the streets, and they were supposed to have that burned mud on them, and they put it on there like it wasn't going to come off.
Yeah.
So, and I remember the box was probably the size of this room, filled with all these bodies that they had to ship out to New York. Two of them, two boxes about the size of this place,
is about 1,000 square foot.
Yeah, it was huge. They were huge. I remember we're loading all these bodies in there, all of them. We're now useless.
Yeah,
I mean, I would be interested to find out if they're.
And you just can't take them and sell them on eBay.
I was like, what's going to happen to all those bodies that we produced? And
man,
that's how much money kind of bled.
You go drop them off at the Goodwill.
Yeah, I mean,
donate them.
But I mean, that indecisiveness seems to me is like one of the things, the hindrances in film. It needs to go back to the days of Stanley Kubrick.
It's a lack of a one man's vision.
Yeah, exactly.
Or one person's vision.
Right.
Where you know it's focused, smaller.
Whether right or wrong, it needs that one direction.
We can't be by committee.
We can't all be George Lucas. Come on.
Right.
Yeah.
But I want to be George. No, you want to be George?
No.
I don't want to be George Lucas.
No, I mean, I like him. I just don't want to be him.
All right.
Can I have his money, though?
What? A measly little $4 billion from Disney?
That's all. I mean, even just a fraction of that, I'd be happy.
You know what? I was just talking to a friend of mine. This veers off a little different.
That's okay.
Path.
Why not?
But we're talking about, you know, surviving and how the business has changed. One of the things I used to do to survive is sculpt for the toy industry. But a friend of mine who also did this, I was just talking to him the other day, and without saying who it is, but this person, I never got anywhere near this kind of money. Mm-hmm. But he would sculpt something for, let's say, Warner Brothers, like a 2 foot tall maquette, mm-hmm. For these companies. And, you know, it would be almost $30,000 mm-hmm. he would get.
Yeah, and they would get, I remember because another friend of mine used to do that too back in the day, and they would get money per inch. Like
$1,000 yeah, per inch. Yeah.
Some insane amount. But now it's like...
There's nothing.
No, because now all they have to do is do a CAT scan and then output it
it's
and
all digital
it
and done. Yeah, it's all done in China.
Yeah, it's all done in China. It's sad, really, because, well, I mean, to me, now, I guess on a serious note, it's like when I look at what CGI has to offer in the lines of practical, I don't want to sound like one of those dinosaurs, like, well, back in the day, we used to make everything out of rubber, you know what I mean? But the reality is something in front of the camera, something there, something practical is inevitably better in the sense of to a certain point. I'll agree to the point that digital effects is a tool. It needs to be utilized as such. It is not the end all be all.
It
is not there for everything.
I don't see a problem of the two being married together.
Exactly. Well, that's my point. But I mean, you can't use one brush to paint a whole painting.
Right.
You have to use the exact tool for to make the thing look right. So if you're going to pull off an effect for something, you know, and if CGI is a part of it, that's fine. But don't use that as your
catch-all. I remember watching Lord of the Rings, and even though some of the CGI is kind of dated at this point, but I thought that they were able to pull together the two worlds.
Yes,
because they really did a lot of large-scale miniature construction, and they had a lot of practical stuff mixed in with the CGI. And I thought at the time, I thought they pulled it off pretty
Plus,
well.
Plus, they would also, especially. In Fellowship of the Ring, there's a scene with a troll, and the camera is in and around, and the troll is fighting, and they're fighting, and it's a lot of handheld camera stuff. Mm-hmm. And they were able to shoot that in a way that, you don't lock down the camera just because there's an effect shot.
So it brings them together.
That's the trouble we had when I worked back in the day, when you see a stop motion shot.
Yep.
It was very rare we were able to even move the camera.
Yeah, as a fan.
It could be done.
You could smell it coming. You're like, oh, this is going to be something, something's going to happen here. Look at the way they framed it.
Right, man. In order for us to actually just move the camera in the middle of a shot was an incredible ordeal. Mm-hmm. It was even before, we didn't use computers or anything, so... Camera was
or motion control.
Control. Yeah. Everything was like locked down.
Yeah.
And so,
you bumped it. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we had to wait for 2 days a day for it to watch it to see what happened.
Now, in terms of makeup specifically, I think one of the first examples I saw of this combining the two was Terminator 3. Schwarzenegger's face starts to deteriorate. He's get blown up by a grenade or a helicopter or something, and you can see through his cheek, through to the stuff underneath, and then to the there's parts of his head that they took away instead of building up. They took away by putting green.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that's
green on his head, and then they could track it and apply.
But again, that's a clever melding of the two.
Yeah, because they also have makeup on his face too. Yeah. Have you worked on anything similar that would use a green screen on a person to do subtractive to aid in that sort of thing? It's pretty specific.
It is a little specific. We've played around with that before. Even on your favorite movie, The Fallen Ones, there was some stuff we were going to play around with when the mummy swallowed that stick of dynamite and his head explodes. And we were going to do this green screen on the side of the cap and all this stuff. For one reason or another, I don't think we got to shooting it. To me, I think it's again, just going back to even like with Pan's Labyrinth, you see the guy, the character walking with those legs. And I mean, it's such a clever way to subtractively have a character or something that is like, that doesn't look human.
All right. I'm remembering now. So he's standing. It was Doug Jones, actually. He's standing
Our
straight
Our good friend
up.
Doug Jones. Right. Yes, a good friend of mine.
He's got the green, green socks on.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And then at the knee, I think probably
well,
at the
I
knee,
think
there
were,
was
like,
something
really thin.
There was something built out behind him.
Right.
Like so the knees, the legs sort of bent backwards.
That's what it was, right. And then they just subtract his green
they
part
took away
in the front.
The green, yeah.
So the legs look like they're bent in this weird, awkward way, which is actually a very difficult thing to do mechanically. We have things called leg extensions.
Right.
Actually, I've done this on this alien abduction found footage film, which I can't really mention because it's going to be, I don't know.
They haven't found it yet.
They haven't found it, apparently. And we shot this like 2 years ago. Yeah? I don't know what's happening.
It's there, but just they said it there, but no one's come across it.
No, yeah, they took their whole movie and left it in a camera, and nobody seemed to have found it.
It'll be on CNN. Geraldo will be revealing it or something.
But it's funny.
Look,
but
it's here in the vault, so Al Capone.
We did these very complicated leg extensions, and I mean, they were problematic in some respects. I mean, but you know, the advantages to the green screen is it minimalizes the amount of mechanical hardware and stuff like that on your actor and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I've worked with Doug. Doug is an awesome guy when it comes to, you know, working with that stuff and just as a suit performer.
What was that project? It was in a morgue, right?
And yeah. I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to say about that.
Maybe not. Okay.
Well, I mean, just to say that we shot basically a teaser trailer for a good friend of mine, Philip Eisner, his project, The Other Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And we shot a teaser trailer, and it had Doug Jones in it. And it was my first time working with him. Great guy and just a great performer. I mean, you can see someone who understands their body and how to utilize, you know, their look and their movement. Mm-hmm. And he's a master at that. And then we had done a couple things afterwards. Something for Machinima, like for Bite Me. Right. We did a little promotional thing with that. And I still get web hits off of that all the time.
So let me ask you, how are you surviving in the CG world?
That's an awful personal question.
Yeah, I know, right?
Jeez. Yeah. Professionally, how are you surviving professionally in the CG-oriented culture of Hollywood?
It's like anything else. I think it's just adapting. You know, either you adapt or you become extinct. I'm finding, like, in the last couple of years, things have been more and more web-based. We were just kind of talking earlier when I first got here that we were up for the Internet Awards again. We're up 2 years in a row. First year, I think, it was for Receiver through Machinima. Mm-hmm. And then this year we were up for Bite Me Season 2.
Congratulations on your nomination.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, we didn't win, though.
Oh, well.
Hey, just to be nominated.
Yes, 2 years in a row. I mean, maybe next year I'll win once they figure out what the category really means. I didn't.
Oh.
I just had to throw that in there.
But I'm sure that'll help your chances.
Oh, I'm sure it will. Yeah.
Put you right at the top of the list.
I'll be curious when I'm not nominated next year. But so with all the stuff, I mean, I've been tailoring. I mean, I'm not one of those people that poo-poo on something because it's going to be on the internet. I don't look at things like, oh, well, it's not really a movie because we're not shooting it on film. It's right. Like, okay, we're shooting it on digital camera, digital equipment. But I mean, still, if you look at some of the quality and some of the stuff that's coming out on the internet, it might as well be on the big screen. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why not. And everything is going towards that direction. I mean, we all know that at some point you're going to plug in your computer to watch, you know, television. Or vice versa. They're going to be intertwined.
It's happening. It's happening now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so to me, it's like, to me, getting in on the ground level and moving forward with that is hopefully, you know, a step in the right direction.
Then did you ever have the impulse to scrap this whole
absolutely.
Career and then go into computer animation or just completely screwing the whole thing and saying, I'm out of here?
At one point, yeah. I mean, I think we all, it's funny. It's like careers are much like a marriage. It could be good and bad. And I think we all hit a point where we look at things and you know, for one reason or another, it's like, well, I just don't see why I'm doing this. And I think that did happen for a little bit. And then it's funny. I shipped everything all back east, where, you know, back to Rochester.
Yeah,
everything, like, that. My whole life, was all back, put back in the basement. I'm like, I'm coming home. That's it. I'm done. I'm going to go to Rochester.
And start trying to make films.
Yeah, and stuff, and start the directing to get into that. And then the more I stayed in L.A., the more I was like, even though at the lowest point, I was like, you know what, I just can't walk away from this. And it sounds stupid, but
it's not stupid. I mean,
it's weird. It's like, it's a
more
dedication.
Than a career. People ask me that. How do you survive? And you, like you said, you have to adapt. Yeah. I went from doing creature effects stuff and special effects, and I still do it, but I morphed into doing production design, art direction, which stemmed from me designing miniatures. It was a natural progression to cinematography and shooting and directing. I mean, it's just one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
one thing dries up, you just either adapt or you die.
Well, not even necessarily drying up either, but even looking at things like in a chronological order. Like, I've always looked at things like, okay, I'm doing effects for somebody else. To me, okay, that's okay, mm-hmm. but ultimately it's always for someone else. Mm-hmm. Then I look at it as, okay, now my company's doing the makeup effects for this show. But ultimately, we're still just doing the makeup effects for a show. Mm-hmm. Then the shows might get a little bit bigger. But in the end, still, you're just doing the makeup, one aspect of it.
Right.
Then now, obviously, through the years, I've been still, you know, I want to get into production, the production end of it, the directing.
Yeah, we talked right. about that, and we discussed that your plans. You have formed a small group out in California. That's a
couple of writing partners.
Right, to start developing your own projects.
Matt Gonos and Matt Mastrella, two buddies of mine, we formed a little production company that we're going to get to. Put everything so that get everything moving this year actually on that. So we already have like two or three shorts written and a couple of feature ideas.
Can you tell
ideas.
Us kind of the ideas you're working on? You want to keep those yourselves?
Well, just right now we have to keep them a little under wraps. But I think between the three of us, we all have a different take and different understanding. Well,
Are you sticking with the horror genre?
Yes. Okay. Right now everything is very much in horror. The horror vein, and it's strange. Like I've mentioned my wanting to direct at other times, and it's strange how some people, either through fear or whatever, have the knee jerk reaction of like, oh, well, you just would do horror. But ultimately, I don't look at films as, okay, this is a horror film. You know, it has to have blood and this and that. It's like, no, it's like, to me, a good film is a good film. One of my favorite horror films is The Shining. No, because I mean, there's something more terrifying about mentally terrifying someone than just showing them gallons of blood. That doesn't mean anything.
Well, I think
you say that about The Shining, which has the biggest elevator, gallons of blood.
As the elevator opens my mind. Yeah,
exactly. But people didn't go see that movie because of the gallons of blood.
Yeah, it wasn't because of the elevator scene. It's because this man is going insane and you're trapped.
It's because of the naked woman that gets out of the bathtub.
Yeah, that's what I saw that movie.
Yes,
definitely.
Yeah. You know what's funny is like I remember my sister and my mother sitting flanking me on the right and left and them trying to cover up my eyes. That and another movie, one of the first ones, and I don't know if any of you have ever seen this movie called The Onion Field. You ever seen this movie?
I've heard of it.
I think I've seen that.
Who's in it?
I don't recall, but there's this a shower scene where they're in prison and something happens. And okay. I remember them trying to cover up my eyes on that. But I have to go back and see it because I haven't seen this movie in years. But must be horrible. But
I keep wanting to get back to see the Corpse Grinders again because I wondered if it's how I remembered it.
It's
I'm
funny.
Still wondering. I'm
it's
wondering,
actually funny.
Let's take Johnny. Yes, that sounds like a movie for the whole family. By the title, the Corpse Grinders.
If anybody doesn't know what that movie is, I'm sure a lot of you don't. It's about these guys who go around making cat food out of people, and then they feed that cat food to the cats. The cats kill the people. They go get the people. They grind them up to make more cat food.
Well,
that's the danger you run into when you run such a company. Yeah.
Isn't that the one where in the beginning they're like on motorcycles and they pull up and they go into someone's apartment? And
I don't remember. All I remember is that theme. Well, because I haven't seen it since I was
eight. Funny part of this, there's a picture of the boyfriend, on the counter, and his reaction in the picture, like they'll change the picture. Mm. Like she's on the phone talking and she says something and then he's like looking up like at her from the photograph.
Right. You know,
they just changed the photograph. And then when she's getting murdered, he's like, so the expression on the photographs that are sitting of her boyfriend are changing as the scene progresses.
It's almost like they weren't taking it seriously.
I don't think they were. But I mean, it's quite clever. I mean,
hey, listen, it was no Herschel Gordon Lewis movie.
Oh, boy. Yeah. God. Yeah, he's still alive.
Oh, yeah. We did a...
Actually, yeah, we interviewed him a couple years ago.
Awesome.
Years back for one of our podcasts.
He's a great guy.
He is.
Where do we go from here?
So we ended up with you talking about wanting to do the production.
Yeah.
Going into that end of it.
The production is something, obviously, I've seen it. I've worked in the film industry since basically I was a kid. And it's like, I mean, I've seen it done good. I've seen it done badly. And I've seen it done so much where it's like, I can do this. And I know my own sensibilities. And it's like, I feel this is the next logical step. And I feel like it's time. It's time. It has to happen now. And it's weird. These last couple of years, I feel this real need to push and push hard. So I'm thinking this is the year, you know, for things to be happening. So definitely keep your eyes out.
I wish you luck. We really appreciate you coming in and talking with us.
I appreciate it as well. You guys are a blast. This was not difficult at all.
No, talking about yourself for a
while. Can you guys unchain me from the table here, please? I mean,
Well, you know, we've been friends for a long time, and I think that makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah,
and,
sort of.
So it's kind sort of, you know. Yeah,
we actually are more unforgiving in real life. We tease our...
Oh, it's awful.
Yes.
It's awful.
We were actually very, very polite to one another here.
Yeah,
I don't
that's
know
right.
why.
Yes, and we kept our...
God,
kept
our
are your pants on?
No, what are you
no my pants are never on.
Mine are off.
Okay.
And his are off. Actually, he's wearing my pants.
Yeah, we switched.
And Mike's going to be... You don't remember pants next?
Oh, well, it's underneath the table. That's
I wish you'd keep your hands in myself. Brings us right back to where we were. Okay, well, listen, I want to thank Mike for coming, and we're going to talk a little bit about Mind Rip. Yeah, people are wondering. I get questions all the time. Hey, how's the movie coming? What's going on? So I thought we'd let people know. We have about 20 minutes of the film in the can, which means is we have 20 minutes of edited footage that we're putting together. We're now in the middle of doing some more stop motion. The plan is we're going to be finishing up the first 30 minutes of the film, hopefully within the next few months, I would hope. And then we're going to take it from there and see what happens.
Sure.
Good luck. Sure. I can't wait to see this completed project. I think it's going to be awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you for your help with it.
Oh, no problem. I want to help more, you know, in whenever possibility I can.
Yeah,
you
know, very good.
Excellent.
Yeah, and if anybody has any questions for Mike, that they can email us.
Oh, yeah, you can email us at feedback@maddogmovies.com. And the podcast address is maddogmovies.com/podcast.
And when I want to, like, advertise for you guys as well for this podcast, how will I go about doing that?
How to advertise for us?
Well, I mean to promote the podcast.
Where are we going to hear this? Where are they going to be able to?
That's maddogmovies.com/podcast. Weren't you listening?
No, I wasn't. No. Can you put a link on, like, maybe my website, too?
Yes, you can put it on your site.
Okay.
Is that what you're going for? How to find your website?
And that would be Multivision FX. Say your website one more
it's
time.
It's multivisionfx.com.
Very nice.
MultivisionFX.com.
Well, thanks for joining us. Another episode of Mad Dog Movies.
Music for this episode was provided by Keith Handy.